We're back, and with us in the studio is Neil Stephenson. Neil, welcome back to Fast Forward.
Good to be here.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've had you on. You've got a lot of books under your belt since then. Your latest one is Rindy, and it's another fairly good-sized book, and this time you wanted to write a thriller.
That's right. The last couple of books have been, we had The Baroque Cycle, a three-volume trilogy, historical novel, and then Anathem, which is kind of a far future thing with some more challenging themes, a lot of metaphysics, a lot of kind of philosophy of math and science. And I'm proud of those books, and I'm very glad I wrote them, but I just felt like writing a good story. So that's what Rindy is.
Yeah, I think you said you wanted to write a big plot book.
That's right. You know, there's many different components to the art of writing fiction. You can focus on prose style. You can focus on characterization or on ideas. And one of those aspects is just pure plot or pure storytelling. And when I was working on The Baroque Cycle, particularly in the middle volume, The Confusion, which is just this great big pirate adventure story, I enjoyed that so much, just on a pure kind of action-filled storytelling level, that it kind of planted a seed in my head that maybe I would like to eventually just sit down and write a book that focused on that particular aspect of the writer's craft. And Rindy is kind of the result of that.
Yeah, it's an amazing plot. I mean, it takes you in one direction, then suddenly kind of makes a left turn, and you go somewhere else, and you're off and running there, and it shifts again. How did you keep track? Because you're moving from all over the world. You know, I forget how many points of view characters you have in the book, and I think it's one of the things that really helps drive the book. How did you manage, just on a process level, to keep everything straight and get it to all tie in?
Well, I wish I could give you some kind of highfalutin answer to that, for the most part, I keep track of it in my head, and I don't think that that's radically more impressive or difficult than what most people who have regular jobs manage to keep in their heads. Okay, so if you think of a contractor who works on houses, for example, at any given point, they've got a few jobs going. They're carrying around the blueprints of a number of different houses in their heads. They've got work schedules. They're thinking about how to get materials and sort of how to work with their subcontractors, you know, and it's a fairly complicated structure in their mind that's always changing. It's dynamic. And they may make use of sort of digital tools or writing things down to help organize that, but for the most part, they're doing it in their heads. And it's a similar case with this. Yeah, it's a complicated plot. There's a lot going on, a lot to think about, but, you know, it's my job. It's what I do for a living. And the best place to keep it is up here. When I absolutely needed to write something down just to make sure I wasn't, you know, screwing something up, I would, I'm sorry to say, just use a plain old spreadsheet.
Just a basic?
Yeah.
Just jump into Excel and
and
keep it straight.
So I know it when you're reading the book and you're getting all of this force-fed to you in a short period of time, it looks really complicated. But fundamentally, is it more complicated than what most people do for a living every day? I kind of doubt it.
Yeah, it's a good point. I had never thought of it that way. Yeah, it makes sense. So the plot's moving around a lot. It's a big book. It's like 1,000 pages.
Yeah.
But I think it was Elizabeth Hand in a review in the Post just the last week or so said it was the fastest reading 1,000 pages she's ever read. What kind of techniques do you use when you're doing a thriller like this, and it's a big book, it's going on, there's a lot of things happening, a lot of different people. What kind of techniques do you use to kind of keep it driving, to keep the reader? I mean, I was up till 2:30 one morning reading this book.
Excellent. Well, one thing that is true of a lot of my books, for some reason, is that they're what I call cluster novels. So The Baroque Cycle, for example, looks like three volumes, but it's really eight separate books of fairly normal length with that are just bound together. And Rindy is divided almost exactly in half. The first half is called Nine Dragons, and it takes place mostly in China. And the second half is called American Falls, and it takes place mostly in the Pacific Northwest. And so that's one way of breaking down a bigger story into more digestible chunks. And then another approach that I think helps to keep things moving is cutting back and forth between, as you mentioned, different point of view characters. So when one of the characters reaches a place in the story where maybe they're going to have a little bit of downtime, you can jump over to the point of view of someone else who's sort of in the thick of it.
Yeah, and something else you did in here that I noticed was you, instead of like chapters, it was days.
Yeah.
Like day one, day two, so that you see what's happening with all the different characters all over the world during that day, and then you move on. So it gives you that timeline of everything moving ahead at a kind of
normal pace. I think that's a helpful way to sort of help organize it in the reader's head, and also a little bit necessary because there's a lot of time zones in this book. You know, as you mentioned, people are kind of all over the place, and so I had to pick one. I think it's probably West Coast time as the my benchmark for when a day begins and ends, and kind of organize it around that kind of clock tick.
Yeah, and the Western time zone is kind of natural for you because that's your home zone.
It's the home zone. It's the home zone of a lot of the primary characters.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit about some of the characters because I love these characters in here.
Oh, thanks.
You've got the Forthrast family,
mm-hmm.
And there's Richard, who's one of the major characters in the book. He's an entrepreneur. He's, you know, his career started in
like a lot of people.
Import-export.
Yeah. Like a lot of people in the real world, he's got a really complicated story, you know. So he's the son of a World War II hero, grew up on a farm in Iowa. His older brother, John, was drafted, fought in the Vietnam War, had his legs blown off by a landmine. Richard decided to avoid that kind of fate, went to Canada to avoid the draft, became a hunting guide, and sort of became aware of more lucrative opportunities in carrying marijuana across the border between British Columbia and Northern Idaho, made enough money from that to start a legitimate business. That succeeded. He found himself with a huge amount of leisure time. He became a video game addict. And once he got sufficiently bored with that, he started a company that makes what's now become an extremely successful video game called Terrain.
Right.
So he's kind of our main character, and we learn his backstory in bits and pieces as the book is opening.
Well, some of it is from like the Wikipedia entries. That's one of the things that's neat about the book is it's a thriller that recognizes the changes that have come about because of technology. I mean, there's people that know things because, you know, there's a scene, I don't want to get too much into it, where somebody realizes that these people have found out all this stuff about her and her family by Googling and going to Wikipedia, and they've got pictures from Facebook up, and they've learned all this stuff and what people are doing by the technology.
Well, there's, in any thriller, you're dealing with what I think of as kind of some laws of physics that govern what happens in that world. And most of the classic thrillers that we're used to involve just a lower level of tech with, you know, dial phones, and there's kind of certain limitations on how information can flow. And those limitations get built into the plot. So one of the things that I wanted to achieve in writing Reamd was to incorporate the new laws of physics into the plot and include Wikipedia and ubiquitous cell phone coverage and GPS and embedded GPS coordinates in your photographs and all of the other stuff that is part of our everyday lives.
Yeah, and it really makes for almost a new kind of thriller, because a lot of old thrillers the plot is driven by people not knowing things.
Right, or not being able to get some information.
Yeah.
Where am I? I can't find my way out of here.
Yeah,
I can't talk to someone.
Or who is this person?
Right.
Or, you know, there's a lot of old movies that wouldn't happen if people had cell phones.
Right.
This is a thriller that uses that to drive the plot. The plot is driven not by what people don't know, but by what people do know.
Yeah. Right. Or efforts to prevent them, you know. But you've got to take it into account either way.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that 20 years from now, people will read it in the same way as you or I might read like an Alistair MacLean thriller. And they'll just say, okay, well, back then, this is the kind of phone that they had, you know. Yeah. It's primitive compared to what we got now. But that's okay. We'll accept that.
Look at it as a historical novel.
As a historical document.
So... I want to go back to some of the characters and some of the fun stuff in the book. The character I see as kind of the most critical character, the character that all the other characters seem to almost revolve around in some way, is Zula.
Mm-hmm.
And I found her a really interesting character. You know, she was from Eritrea and, you know, went through all kinds of nasty stuff there, got adopted by the Fourth Ras family. What was the seed? What drove her for you as a character?
Well, the part of it is the it just comes out of the way our society is now. You know, I mean, I have spent a lot of time the last couple of decades in Seattle, which is obviously an incredibly international city at the moment, and families are not as simple as they used to be. There's a lot of adoption taking place. There's a lot of interracial, sort of mixed race stuff going on, and not just in big cities like Seattle, but also in the Midwest, which is where Zula grew up. And so I wanted to just present that as sort of the way it is today, not make a big deal out of it, That was part of it, I guess, and sort of enough to kind of get the story going.
Yeah, I mean, the fact of her background isn't critical to the story, but it really works into her character and how she reacts to things as she goes back. And learning in this book, as in a lot of what you do, if not everything, knowing the history, knowing the background of things is very important to the characters. So in this book, like in your other books, when you go in and give what in other hands might be an info dump about the, you know, the history of the city or the history of the geology of this land and how, you know, the talus would work in here, it's the characters knowing about it, and it's part of, to me, what is part of your philosophy is knowing the history of something, knowing the background of things and people and places gives you competence.
Yeah, and there's a certain amount of calibration that goes on there. I think in early drafts, I tend to maybe put in more of that than is strictly needed. But then during the process of reading it and rereading it, what happens is that sometimes you'll come across one of those and you'll say, or I'll say, oh, well, that's an interesting little side point, but it's a digression. You know, we don't really need to know how they make tea in Fujian, you know, so I'll take out the whole page where I describe the tea making ritual. On the other hand, the slope of a scree or talus hillside is of direct relevance to this plot because it means that bullets are going to pass straight up the slope and there's nowhere to hide. Yeah, so.
And how you have to go up it if you're running away from the bullets is important too.
Right, right.
And so, you know. I want to talk some, to go into that a little bit about the research you did. The first part of the book takes place mostly in a city in China.
Xiamen.
Which everyone gets confused, and everyone says, is that where the terracotta soldiers are? I love that. It's like everyone goes, no, that's the other one.
Right.
How did you do the research? Because the detail of what you're writing about that city, it's like you're there.
Well, I went there.
Helps.
Yeah. I am a surprisingly bad traveler. When I go to some place alone, my tendency is to just hole up in the hotel room with the do not disturb sign on the doorknob and just surf the internet until it's time to check out, which is, you know, not very productive of literature. So as it happens, There's a book out now, a nonfiction book called 1493 by Charles Mann, which is a fantastic book. It's gotten a lot of attention, deservedly. It's doing pretty well. It's by Charles Mann. Charles is a friend of mine, and I heard a couple of years ago that he was going to China to do some research for this book, and had a translator and sort of guide, I guess you could say, lined up, named Josh D'Aloisio Guerreri, who's based out of Taiwan and totally fluent in Chinese. And so I just asked him if I could tag along, because I knew I wanted my story to be set in China, but I didn't want to go for one of the big cities that we're familiar with, like Beijing or Shanghai. Because one of the interesting things about China is that there's some amazing number of cities there with multiple millions of people in them that most of us have never heard of. So I wanted it to be one of those. Xiamen was a good match for what I needed. He was going there, so I just went there and I just tagged along. And those guys were going to places I never would have gone to. And it didn't matter to me where I went. I just needed a city. And so I was able to kind of just wander around and take notes and get ideas.
Yeah, because you can feel it. You can feel the heat. You can almost smell the city. You can see the buildings.
Well, I think you've got to do that in this kind of book, right? I mean, the experience, what I'm selling and what you're buying is an experience of immersion into a fictional world. Yeah. That's the entertainment experience, if you will, that people are looking for. And so to achieve that, you've got to supply enough explanation to create that effect that you're describing. So, oh, I'm there, I know what this smells like, without going too far and turning it into a PhD dissertation.
Yeah. Before we run out of time, what are you working on next?
Well, I've got an idea in mind, a couple of ideas, but the one that's kind of the leading candidate for the next book is sort of a big, hard science fiction kind of saga.
Oh, okay, that'll be fun.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you doing SF.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
I mean, particular kind of SF, is it going to be far future? Do you know yet?
I think it would be a combination of that with very sort of present day stuff.
I'd like to see you try like a space opera. That'd be fun.
Well, depending on your definition of that, this might fill your bill.
Yeah. Well, we are out of time.
Okay.
I got so much more I'd like to talk to you about. We can't do it. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
It was a pleasure to do it.
And if you're ever in the area, do it again.
I will.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
Well, from all of us here at Fast Forward, this is Mike Zipser saying, take care.